there's another part of this bill. There's $4 billion in this bill you all might not know about that goes to help the drought, the Western drought. And that's basically trying to convince people not to use the amount of water they've been using in order to have the water that's going to be needed for survival.
West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin speaking to reporters outside the White House yesterday after President Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act. The new law does a lot of things, especially when it comes to taxes and health care, but it's also the biggest climate bill in decades. And what Manchin is talking about there is a provision that would compensate farmers who voluntarily reduce their water use. Biden signed the new law the same day the federal government ordered Arizona, Nevada, and Mexico to curb their use of water from the Colorado River. California isn't affected yet. We're going to talk about what's in the Inflation Reduction Act for farmers with Tom Philpott. He covers food and agriculture for Mother Jones, and he's also author of the book Perilous Bounty: The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. Welcome back to Press Play, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
So this bill pumps around $20 billion over 10 years into a bunch of agriculture conservation programs. What will they do?
Well, generally speaking, these are programs that will help farmers diversify their farms when you bring more crops into your farms, generally there's benefits. You're using less pesticides, you're using less fertilizers. It incentivizes farmers to use cover crops. You know, basically, the idea is to nudge farmers, give, you know, farmers a carrot to sort of draw them into the direction of making their farms more sustainable, using less, you know, less greenhouse gas emissions and storing more carbon in soils. Those are the basic goals.
What about reducing their use of water and having better irrigation systems?
There would be some money for California farmers in those programs to do stuff like that. So I think it would, you know, it's very much based on region. So in the Midwest, it's about crop diversification. And in California, those programs would be more about, you know, helping farmers put in drip irrigation, which uses less water and things like that.
What about paying them not to farm, paying them to fallow their land?
Well, the conservation programs we're talking about would be more about getting them to shift to less water-intensive crops, bringing pasture back to the Central Valley, grazing lands and things like that. There's another part of the bill that in the places like the Imperial Valley, major farming region for the whole country, where farmers there are reliant on Colorado River water, it would compensate them for letting some of that water go. That would be a way in which it would pay farmers to fallow land. Like, I'm not going to irrigate alfalfa or lettuce on this crop in the winter. And that $4 billion would have some money in there for them to compensate them for leaving that land fallow. It won't really make much of a difference in the Central Valley, though, which is a whole different water system.
Right. And we're hearing a lot about these cutbacks from the Colorado River. California, as I mentioned, is not affected yet, but Arizona is affected and also a big farming area. So do you think that this will come to California eventually, these cutbacks?
I think it has to. I mean, I think there was a big agreement in the 1920s. So a long time ago, Imperial Valley farmers got this amazing water right. It's a century old. Things that are quite a bit different now. And you've got lots of cities in the area that could really use some of that water. The Imperial Valley has already surrendered some water in a big deal to San Diego a couple of decades ago. And I think they're going to be under pressure to do more of that going forward, because this long drought is just sapping the Colorado River at its headwaters up in the Rocky Mountains.
Right. And some people are saying, well, if we can't grow as many crops here, Mexico can pick up the slack and we can import our agriculture from Mexico. But doesn't Mexico also rely on the Colorado River?
Yes. Some of the biggest growing regions in Mexico are just south of you in Baja California, Sinaloa area. But especially Baja California, those farms are reliant on the exact same water resource, and they're already getting squeezed out. So one of the things I talk about in my book is that we're not going to import our way out of this problem. Most of the places in the world that have really good growing conditions for fruits and vegetables also are having a water pinch now, driven by climate change. And so that's something that we're going to have to figure out as a society and not rely completely on imports.
And do you think that this bill goes a long way to addressing that? Or is it, as you know, one could say, a drop in the bucket?
I would have to say a drop in the bucket or a baby step. It is great that there's this conservation money. It's great that there's this $4 billion for drought relief in the Colorado River Basin. But this is a very, very early step. And I think what is going to be not just a California problem, but a national problem, because we rely so much on California for what we eat.
And so when you look at this bill and what it wants to do, and you look at what's happening with the Colorado River and the drought, where do you see California agriculture in 5 to 10 years?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, I think what we're looking at in California agriculture is a scaling down to meet where the water resources are. I mean, I think we've had decades and decades of scaling up California agriculture, kind of regardless of water resources. And I think that era has ended. And I think the big decisions that are going to be made are, you know, as we scale the agriculture down, what crops are, what uses are we going to emphasize? And what are we going to let go? I mean, I think this is a big question for California agriculture. And is it just going to be, you know, lots and lots of dairy, lots and lots of nuts, stuff like lettuce in the Imperial Valley? Something's got to give. And those are the decisions that are going to have to be made. But the trend is going to be a scaling down in the Imperial Valley and in the Central Valley.
What is the best crop in terms of bang for your buck water-wise?
Wow, that is a really complicated question. I think the best bang for your buck is probably nut crops. There's a lot of bucks in those nuts.
Yeah, that's true, but a lot of water in those nuts too.
And a lot of water too, but you know, if you look at the compensation farmers get, this is why we've had this nut boom. But I think we have to ask a question about, you know, as a society, what is the best bang for our dollars as a society, not for the necessarily for the landowners? And I think a diversity of crops that are directed to feeding people the kinds of foods that they need. And I think nuts are a part of that, but maybe a much smaller part of that. And, you know, stuff like fruits and vegetables and things that people can actually eat. I think, you know, dairy could be very much scaled down, and that's sort of not just those big dairy farms you see on the side of the road, but also alfalfa, which is a major crop. I think this could be scaled way down because Americans are drinking much less milk than they used to, and yet the dairy industry is bigger than ever. We can and should see that scale down.
Well, Tom, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. That's Tom Philpott, food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones and author of the book Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. Coming up, an in-depth investigation into how the Trump administration carried out the family separation policy at the U.S.-Mexico border. The families are still traumatized.
A lot of the kids are experiencing developmental delays, so things like bedwetting, loss of vocabulary, just feeling, you know, fearful of leaving home.
A big investigation into what led up to zero tolerance and its aftermath next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In the spring of 2018, the Attorney General under President Trump, Jeff Sessions, stood before cameras in San Diego and announced an immigration policy that would come to define the Trump administration.
If you are smuggling a child, then we will prosecute you. And that child may be separated from you as required by law.
The policy was called Zero Tolerance. It had already quietly been in effect as a pilot program for about a year. Well, after audio of sobbing children in detention centers was broadcast, there was bipartisan outrage, and Trump quickly ended the policy a month and a half after Sessions' announcement. All told, around 4,000 kids had been separated from their families. At the time, the Trump administration insisted separating kids from their parents was merely an unfortunate consequence of the policy, not its ultimate goal. But that wasn't true, according to my next guest, Caitlin Dickerson, who covers immigration for The Atlantic. She spent more than a year investigating the legacy of zero tolerance and interviewed more than 100 people about it for her cover story in the magazine's current issue. She reveals how separating families was always the administration's goal, that all of its worst outcomes were anticipated, and that some officials actively worked to keep families from being reunified sooner. Caitlin Dickerson joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline.
So you write that the idea of separating families really predated the Trump administration. Where did it come from, this idea?
So the idea to separate families as a deterrent for migration first comes from a man named Tom Homan. He's been in the Border Patrol or in border enforcement since he was in his 20s. And under the Obama administration in 2014, your listeners might remember, there was a big surge of unaccompanied minors as well as families crossing the border. And the Obama administration was really scrambling to figure out how to process all of them and what to do about these changing trends in migration. And so the Homeland Security Secretary at the time, Jay Johnson, convened a meeting with his heads of enforcement, his brightest minds in the administration, and asked for solutions. And Tom Homan, who was a high-ranking deputy at ICE, proposed the idea to separate kids from their parents, arguing that, you know, the word of it would make its way back to Central America and would discourage other families from making this journey to the United States. So it would serve as a deterrent. And there are, you know, academic researchers who look at these deterrent strategies say that's not true. This premise wouldn't have held up. But that was Homan's thinking when he proposed it to Johnson, who at the time declined to proceed.
So he declined to proceed and this idea gets shelved. And then how is it revived under the new administration?
So very similarly, when President Trump takes office, as you know, after having campaigned on this idea of really securing the Southwest border, minimizing migration across it as much as possible, meetings start right away, where again, people who run the enforcement apparatus were asked to present their best ideas. And Tom Homan's idea resurfaces. It's presented to Stephen Miller, President Trump's chief immigration advisor in the White House, who gets excited about it and latches onto it and continues to push for it for a year and a half until it's formally introduced.
And so how big a role did Stephen Miller have in getting this policy through?
So Stephen Miller, as you know, your listeners won't be surprised to know that he pushed relentlessly and aggressively for the separation of families and really all the other harsh enforcement tactics that the Trump administration pursued. But actually what I learned in reporting this story is that just as critical and maybe even more critical than Miller and then a colleague of his, Gene Hamilton's, who worked over at the Justice Department and played a really similar role to Miller, maybe even a more integral one, he's just lesser known, you know, just as critical to them were the members of the bureaucracy who they convinced to either go along with their ideas or just stay quiet in meetings and not object to them. You know, it's impossible to put into place a policy this expansive, one that impacts thousands of families, without buy-in that's a lot wider than just, you know, those people in the administration with the harshest views. But nevertheless, Miller did push very hard for this to happen.
Right. And his tactics were just extremely aggressive, as you say, that he would call up, as you detail in your story, he would call up administration officials like in the middle of the night to talk to them and berate them that they are not moving fast enough on this policy. But he was relatively low down on the totem pole. I mean, he wasn't at a cabinet level at all. Why would they listen to him?
I was told that there was this mystique surrounding Miller because of a narrative that developed in the White House. And remember, this was an administration that did not expect to actually win the 2016 election. The Trump campaign was very surprised and felt ultimately that the reason they won was because of Trump's positions on immigration, because of his speeches about immigration. And they gave Miller all the credit, really, for Trump's win, because he was the speechwriter during Trump's campaign. He was the one who was creating these talking points that Trump would, you know, deliver at his campaign rallies. And so Miller was then viewed by Trump and his closest circle, you know, really his children, as critical to President Trump holding on to power and even winning a second term. And so as a result, Miller really became untouchable.
And so did these cabinet secretaries think, well, whatever Miller says, Trump has approved, and it's basically Trump speaking, so I better do what I'm told or better do what he says?
I don't think the cabinet secretaries and other people in positions of authority thought that Miller was speaking for Trump. Everybody kind of understood that Miller was acting completely out of turn. It's more that they feared, frankly, challenging him because they knew that, you know, in a fight between Miller and them, you know, whether we're talking about these cabinet secretaries or heads of agencies, you know, that Miller was going to win. And so they weren't going to go to the president or his chief of staff and try to get Miller in trouble because they figured it wouldn't happen. And in fact, they might face consequences for even raising the issue.
But there were people who were staunchly opposed to this in the administration, and they would face off against these hawks. How did those conversations go?
When I asked some of the more moderate members of the administration, and frankly, not even moderate members, you know, conservative members of the administration, but people who say they oppose separating families, what meetings were like when this idea was discussed, you know, I was told these were speak when spoken to environments. They were not environments where people were being asked, you know, do you have any pushback? Do you have any concerns? Those questions weren't raised. And so that was really a reason that was presented to me for why certain people stayed quiet. But anybody who was identified as being skeptical of this idea, over time, they were cut out of conversations about it. So that ultimately, when you have this decision being made by Kirstjen Nielsen, who was then the Homeland Security Secretary who approved of zero tolerance, you know, skeptics were really not welcome in the room. And so any kind of criticism just wasn't taken into consideration.
So let's talk about Kirstjen Nielsen, because she really did become the face of this policy. And I just want to play a clip of tape of her from a briefing. This is just after ProPublica releases a piece of audio it obtained of detained children. And it's really heart-wrenching to hear them. They're crying. They're screaming for their parents. And later that day, Nielsen has to go in front of reporters in the White House briefing room. And here she is taking questions from reporters and basically taking the line that we're just doing what we are legally required to do. Here's what she says.
Congress is the one that needs to fix this.
This policy is not, by your definition, in any way cruel.
It's not a policy. Our policy at DHS is to do what we're sworn to do, which is to enforce the law.
Right.
Yes.
You spoke with Kirstjen Nielsen for this piece. And what are her thoughts now when she saw just how horrific this policy ended up being with these children? Some were infants, still in diapers, still breastfeeding, taken away from their parents.
Mm-hmm. Nielsen is a really kind of complicated and conflicted person who, as you pointed out, is the face of family separations, really became that in the press conference that we just heard, but also somebody who was really skeptical of the idea until it was ultimately implemented. So she shared with me, and as did her advisors and people not even close to her, but who were around in these rooms as this decision was being debated and then ultimately made, shared with me that the information put in front of Nielsen really wasn't good about zero tolerance. Starting from, you know, the basics, she was assured that infrastructure existed to prevent prolonged separations from happening. That, of course, wasn't true. She and her advisors were also assured that this had been done before, that significant numbers of parents had been prosecuted in the past, even those traveling with their children, which, of course, would suggest that either, you know, significant numbers of family separations didn't result, or they weren't controversial because they never made it into the news. And it really just minimized the significance of the decision that she was making. And so she now says that she regrets making the decision to approve of zero tolerance, but she doesn't apologize for what happened. And I think she's one of a lot of people I interviewed for this story who also feel like the media really exaggerated its reporting of family separations and still don't totally believe in its fullness what happened.
But what you also detail is that there really wasn't any plan to reunify the families. And how could she have approved this without hearing whether or not there was a reunification plan?
When I asked people, how did you expect this to play out? What did you think that it was going to look like? They all gave me a different answer, which I think just speaks to how little detail these discussions went into, which is, of course, cause for concern when you're talking about separating children from their parents. You know, I think in a best case scenario, some people like Nielsen perhaps told themselves that the prosecutions would happen in a matter of days, if not hours, which does sometimes happen along the border. I mean, some happen really quickly. But then, of course, you know, I have records that are written about in the piece where you see ICE officials, you know, one in particular, Matt Albence, who was a very high-ranking deputy there, actually raising concerns that families might be reunified after prosecutions took place. And then when some of those reunifications started to happen, he tried to stop them. He tried to make sure that families would stay separated longer. So very, very little planning took place, you know, these very baseline assurances with no detail. And then, of course, people trying to stop reunifications.
And was that because they were still wedded to this idea that this would be the most effective deterrent?
I think that's a fair inference to take away from the emails that we have. You know, one email from Matt Albence says that, you know, these swift reunifications would make the department look bad or would totally undermine the goal of the entire effort. Another email from a woman named Sandy Goldhammer, who's actually the longtime partner of Carla Provost, you know, the chief of the Border Patrol at the time, she wrote in an email that prosecution in and of itself was not the consequence that they were looking for, which I think, you know, it's fair to say implies they were looking for a harsher consequence. It is possible, and I've heard the argument, that some people who were lamenting these reunifications in writing were concerned about just general logistical chaos, which was rife throughout the entire implementation of this policy. You know, I think that begs the obvious question, you know, why is your biggest concern logistics and not families being brought back together? So you're either talking about people who are trying to prolong these consequences and make this experience worse for families, or people who cared more about logistics than getting them back together.
But I guess, you know, what else is shocking is that there actually wasn't any way, if they wanted to reunify, there wasn't a central database that officials kept about where the children were and where the parents were and how to reunify them.
That's right. And again, that speaks to the very little planning and anticipation that took place ahead of time. There's a U.S. attorney, one of those who are stationed along the Southwest border and who prosecuted zero tolerance cases, quoted in my story, talking about the experience of these U.S. attorneys who really didn't understand at the outset that families were going to be separated. You know, they only see parents who show up in court and they just sort of assume that reunifications took place later. And so this U.S. attorney says, you know, about 5,000 separations, you know, it's a very large number in terms of human consequences, but it's not a large number in terms of data management. Why don't we simply have an Excel spreadsheet to keep track of families? He also says, you know, you could have done something even simpler, like put wristbands on parents and children, you know, with a matching ID number. Really, any, you know, number of measures could have been taken to try to make reunifications easier. And my reporting showed that just nobody thought about this. You know, nobody took a second to come up with a solution for this problem, except for, of course, people within the bureaucracy who were raising red flags about separating families. They did think about this, but their concerns and their recommendations were completely ignored.
What's also shocking is that the head of HHS, Alex Azar at the time, didn't really know this was going on.
That's right. So Alex Azar, you know, really for a year didn't understand that, you know, the immigration portfolio of his agency at all. He was really focused on working on prescription drug pricing and an overhaul in that policy. And so, and he's, you know, he's not somebody who cares a lot about immigration, and in fact delegated everything that his agency dealt with that didn't have to do with prescription drug pricing, including immigration. So it just wasn't on his radar, despite months and months of reporting, you know, for me and many other reporters pointing out these separated kids were ending up in his agency's care. And, you know, I think his story is important because there are so many people in government who do not understand immigration, even those who really should, and whose jobs require it. You know, a lot of people just seem like they can't be bothered to get up to speed on this issue, which again, of course, you know, can be life and death for people. Or in this case, you know, we're talking about a policy that has lifelong consequences.
Right. And so what are some of the consequences that you reported on? How are the families now handling this?
Separated families are, unsurprisingly, suffering very significantly at this point. And, you know, it's hard to put into words because, you know, suffice it to say, I spend a lot of time interviewing people who are fleeing harrowing circumstances or who are in harrowing circumstances. And the interviews that I've done with families that were separated, they stand completely apart. You know, I can pick up the phone and talk to a parent who was separated from their child for a few months, even one who's reunified now. And, you know, as soon as we begin to talking about this experience, they're immediately in tears and really, frankly, a lot of times experiencing PTSD flashbacks. A lot of the kids are experiencing developmental delays, so things like bedwetting, loss of vocabulary, just feeling, you know, fearful of leaving home and really not trusting anybody and constantly worried that they could be separated from their parents again. Parents are really struggling with the same issues, and a lot of times not doing as much to treat their own problems because they're focused on their kids and focused on trying to rebuild their relationships with their kids. I mean, their relationships have really suffered. I've heard both parents and kids say to me, you know, this is not the person I was separated from. I don't really recognize them. And so that's why even those who are in the best situations, you know, who were reunified after a few months, still very much feel like this experience is with them every day.
That's so sad. Plus, some still have not been reunited. There are, what, 185 or so separated children?
So there are actually more than that. There are between 700 and 1,000 kids who haven't officially been reunited with their parents, according to government records. You know, a very large number. Wow. Some of those families are thought to have found each other and just not reported it to the U.S. government, kind of understandably not wanting to deal with the U.S. government after what they went through. But many of those families are not reunited. You know, the kids might be living with an extended family member in the United States or a family friend, but that's nothing like being reunited with your actual parent, of course. And then the number you pointed to is actually about 185, and it goes down a little bit. So it might be closer to 150, to be fair, today. Parents of children just have not been located at all. You know, after all this time, the U.S. government does not even know where those parents are.
So there is no more official policy of separating parents and their children, but the idea is still kicking around. And if, you know, Trump wins again, if he runs again and wins again, perhaps he might reinstate it, or another Republican administration might reinstate it.
I think there's no question that family separations will be on the table again, you know, in a future Trump administration or an administration that looks anything like it. You know, Trump pushed really hard to reinstate separating families really as soon as they stopped with the executive order that he introduced to just quickly snuff out all the frustration they were facing.
We're signing an executive order. I consider it to be a very important executive order. It's about keeping families together, while at the same time being sure that we have a very powerful, very strong border, and border security will be equal, if not greater, than previously. So we're going to have strong, very strong borders, but we're going to keep the families together. I didn't like the sight or the feeling of families being separated.
But Trump really regretted it and tried to get, you know, his Homeland Security secretaries to re-implement family separations for the remainder of his administration. But again, almost more importantly, right, there are so many members of that bureaucracy, so many members of these longtime community of immigration enforcement officials who have high-ranking positions and who would certainly come back in a future administration like Trump's, who still believe that this was a really good idea and that it was successful. And a lot of them would whisper to me kind of under their breath in an interview things like, you know, most people don't like to acknowledge that family separations actually work, that zero tolerance was actually effective. So many people who still believe.
Well, was it? I mean, from that point of view, from their point of view, was it? Did it dissuade immigrants?
It actually didn't. And so it's mind-boggling why they continue to go back to this idea. Certainly, you know, we should stipulate that when they say worked, they mean minimizing border crossings. But if you recall, you know, President Trump's biggest year for border crossing, when records were broken, nearly a million people crossed the border, was 2019, the year after family separations began. This was not a meaningful deterrent in any substantial way. You know, for a long time, researchers have known that the biggest indicators of immigration are economics and safety conditions, both here and in the home countries people are leaving from to come to the United States. You know, deterrence really is a drop in the bucket in comparison, and it also comes with these very serious human consequences. But I think why we keep seeing deterrence stay popular and come back up and even increase at its harshness is because, as we talked about at the outset here, you know, Congress has not intervened. Congress has not updated our laws to address the current situation at the border. And so you basically have this police force that's left to figure it out on their own. You know, they're not economists. They're not makers of humanitarian policy. They're enforcement authorities. And so this is really the only tool at their disposal.
Well, Caitlin, thank you so much for your story and your reporting. And thanks for being here with us to tell us about it. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks for having me.
Caitlin Dickerson covers immigration for The Atlantic. Her story is on the cover of the current issue. It's called We Have to Take Away Children, The Secret History of the U.S. Government's Family Separation Policy. Coming up, how the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which puts on the Golden Globes, are trying to come back after scandal, and the sorry state of SoulCycle and other fancy gyms. Those stories are next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Even with stupid things, inclusivity is important, and there are no black members of the Hollywood Foreign Press. I realize HFPA, maybe you guys didn't get the memo because your workplace is the back booth of a French McDonald's, but you got to change that.
Comedian Tina Fey hosting the 2021 Golden Globes. She delivered her monologue right after the revelation by the Los Angeles Times that there were no black members of the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the group behind the Globes. The Times also revealed corruption among some of its members. Major Hollywood talent and studios boycotted the awards and the organization. And now, more than a year later, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association is still struggling to repair its image. Just last week, the group's president, German journalist Helen Huna, was put on blast. It was at the Martha's Vineyard African American Film Festival, where a top Hollywood publicist grilled her on the group's diversity efforts. Here to talk about this is Sharon Waxman, editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Hi, Sharon.
Hey, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, you spoke with Cassandra Butcher. She is this publicist, one of Hollywood's top publicists, and she was at this film festival. Describe what happened according to her. What did she say? She asked Huna, and what happened then?
Yeah. So let me just also just adjust one of the things in your intro, which is the LA Times were not the first to write about the fact that there were no black members of the Hollywood Foreign Press, because sadly, or for better or worse, I've been writing about this issue since 1996. And I wrote in 2014 that there were no black members the association. But I think that the revelation, so to speak, as you put it, landed much more strongly in the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement. And that really did move the needle, that LA Times investigative piece. But, you know, this stuff has been out there. And I personally and the staff here at The Wrap have been writing about this pretty much constantly since for, and me personally for 25 years. So anyway, to go back to your question about what happened at that event. So the Hollywood Foreign Press has been trying to repair its image and has been trying to put a message out there that it is committed to both cleaning up corruption, to reform efforts, and to diversifying the organization. And one of the efforts, that those PR efforts, was to have this conversation at the a very famous film festival in the African-American community. It's called the Martha's Vineyard African-American Film Festival. And they were speaking to a largely Black audience, and several people, including Cassandra Butcher, stood up and challenged whether, in fact, those reform efforts had been taking place. So the whole point of this panel was to kind of tout the efforts that the Hollywood Foreign Press has been making. And here were people in the audience who were informed and knowledgeable and basically saying, well, what actually have you done? What's the timetable for getting that done? And Cassandra is one of about 100 publicity and marketing executives who have been boycotting essentially Hollywood Foreign Press press conferences. And so they've not sent their talent. So there have not been press conferences now in well over a year. And the question as to how that will allow any forward movement towards restoring the Golden Globes is still a very open question.
Yeah. Well, how did President Hoonah respond when she was confronted by Cassandra?
I wasn't there, so I didn't witness the exchange. But we did, you know, I spoke to Cassandra, and then we also spoke to the Hollywood Foreign Press, and they covered the event themselves on the Golden Globes, their website. So, you know, she pointed to the fact that they are taking this very seriously, that the Hollywood Foreign Press has appointed an executive in charge of diversity and inclusion, that they've added 6 members, but they were supposed to be adding, you know, more than double that amount of Black journalists. There are some journalists of color, but there have not been any Black journalists for as long as I can remember.
We just received a statement moments ago from the HFPA denying the fact that it never had Black members in its 75-year history and pointed to one man named Lowell Stain, who was a member, they say, from 1977 until he died in 1998. And again, as you say, they went on to chronicle their more recent efforts. How would you characterize those recent efforts? Are they well-intentioned? Are they bearing fruit?
That's a really good question. I think that the general impression is that they take 2 steps forward and 2 steps back. So it doesn't really leave them with very much progress. And the recent piece of news that has happened is that the interim CEO of the Hollywood Foreign Press, who is a hedge fund billionaire named Todd Boehly, who owns many other properties, including the Beverly Hilton, where the Golden Globes takes place, including MRC, the production house that used to be called Dick Clark Productions, that produces the Golden Globes and takes half of the licensing fee that NBC pays, that he has been the interim CEO, and now he has convinced the membership to sell him the HFPA. So he, as of like a week or two ago, owns the HFPA. It is not going to be a nonprofit association as most credible awards-based organizations are. It will be privately owned, and they're going to try and, I believe, triple the voting membership from 100 to 300, but they're paying a salary to the 100 members, but will not be paying anything to the other new voters. So, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think a lot of us are wondering what exactly this organization is besides the sponsor of the Golden Globes.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the Hollywood Foreign Press is as the article that I wrote about Cassandra mentions, they're about 75 years old. They are an association that brings together non-American journalists who cover Hollywood. And that was the intention. And I think it served that purpose for a long time, at least nominally, with the idea that you're going to, that Hollywood puts out films, and it's come to include television as well, that goes out to the world. And that is that is American popular culture that goes out to the world and has really passionate audiences around the world. And of course, for a long time now, the international box office has eclipsed in size the American box office. So it's considered something really important to get the word out to foreign journalists. But the reality is that the members of the Hollywood Foreign Press have largely been a ragtag group of freelancers, because many countries don't invest and don't have reason to invest in having a US-based journalist here. And so it was always a crony kind of culture where you needed everyone to vote on a new member. Anybody could object to a new member, so people would like protect their territory. It was always like, my friend is my friend and they get to be in. And so that's what I discovered when I came to Hollywood in 1996 for the Washington Post. I was really amazed to find out that this existed, and that there were these crazy perks that you would go on these junkets, all paid hotels, cruises, where they, wine and dine you. And all of this really was not in the service of the journalism. It was really in the service of building relationships with this tiny group of voters. And the Golden Globes were built up into this great marketing juggernaut that helped promote movies during the awards season and were a precursor to the Oscars. So over the years, as these various corrupt and sort of questionable, ethically questionable practices were revealed by myself and other journalists, they kept trying to adjust and change and tighten the rules, but it never really worked, and it still doesn't work.
Sharon, thank you so much for updating us.
Yes. Anytime.
It is quite a complicated story. Sharon Waxman, editor-in-chief of The Wrap. Before the pandemic, the spinning gym Soul Cycle was kind of the it exercise fad. Michelle Obama, Beyonce, Jay-Z, Victoria Beckham, they could sometimes be seen in classes. Last week, though, Soul Cycle announced it was going to close roughly a quarter of its gyms. But it's not like at-home workout companies are doing great either. Peloton announced last week it's going to lay off hundreds of people as it struggles to figure out a path forward after being the it workout of the pandemic. So what does this say about our new exercise habits? We're going to talk to Bethany Byron now. She's been all over this story for Business Insider. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, let's talk about SoulCycle first. Why is it closing all of these stores?
Yeah, so on Friday, their CEO had a meeting with the team to announce they're closing 19 studios in what she described as oversaturated markets. So they, despite, reopening, the pandemic restrictions lessening and people wanting to do group in-person classes again, they still just weren't getting enough foot traffic in certain locations. So they ultimately decided to close those specific stores and lay off ultimately several employees as well. They're trying to relocate them to different studios if possible, but they're definitely in a time of transition.
Well, is it because people really aren't as excited as they thought they might be to go back into a cycling gym?
I think that's part of it. I think also the cost of these classes are still pretty high. You know, it's almost $40 to take a SoulCycle class. And despite largely attracting, celebrities and affluent clientele, inflation's still hurting a lot of people. And I think a lot of people are seeking cheaper routes beyond like $40 fancy gym classes.
$40? That's how much it costs?
Yeah, I believe it's 36 in most markets, and that doesn't include shoe rental. So yeah, it's pretty lofty.
Oh my goodness. Okay, well, I guess a lot of those people are biking on Pelotons at home, and that's not exactly cheap, but maybe it's cheaper than $40 a class.
Yeah, and interestingly, a few weeks ago, SoulCycle actually launched this promotion where people could turn in their used Pelotons to SoulCycle, and in return, SoulCycle would give them a large cluster of a package of classes. I think it's like 60 classes or something, the equivalent of the cost of a Peloton bike. So it's kind of a a cheeky little promotion, but also I would say, you know, a harbinger of things to come for the company, as we have since seen.
Well, meanwhile, Peloton is laying off around 800 people and also raising the price of its bikes. So what's going on there?
Yeah, Peloton has had a pretty rough year. I think they were definitely the darling of the early pandemic. Everyone wanted a Peloton. Their sales are rising. They were thriving. And then again, as you know, things changed, people wanted to work out outside, do group fitness. Their sales started to fall off a little bit there. So this is actually their third round of layoffs since February. They're also going through some executive shakeups. So a lot of kind of identity crisis transitioning happening there as well.
So where are people exercising? What are they doing now?
Yeah, so we're seeing a big uptick and increase in low cost budget gyms. So, you know, the Planet Fitnesses of the world are actually doing quite well right now. They announced earlier this month that they added 300,000 new members. They grew their locations by 34 new stores. It seems like many Americans are enticed by, you know, like a $10 gym where they can get in, get out, do all their necessary things. It's just an easier, cheaper option for many people.
Right. And I guess it's a back to basics kind of fitness where you just really didn't need a fancy class and candles and expensive bikes. You just need a treadmill and a set of weights.
Yeah, exactly.
And so are people actually leaving their homes now and going back to the gym, or is it kind of a mixed bag?
It seems like a bit of a mixed bag. Obviously, again, like these lower budget gyms are doing well. People are getting back to the gym. People are going back to classes. But I think as we've seen in SoulCycle's case, despite them reopening all of their clubs and trying to get people back in using various marketing and promotion campaigns, people just still aren't coming back in at the same rate. I think part of that is there was such a boom of and diversification of different types of workouts during the pandemic. A lot of those were at home or digital. But as a result, it's just like such a kind of crowded market of different options, different ways to work out. It's just that there are a lot of different things you can do now. And I think as a result, you know, certain exercises are starting to feel that.
So what is the way forward for smaller boutique gyms, not the big discount chains like Planet Fitness? Is there a space for them?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I spoke to an analyst the other day who essentially said, you know, stationary bikes are never going to die. They've been a huge fad since the 1970s. People always want, you know, the option to work out inside if there's inclement weather or, you know, just the convenience. So they're going to stick around. I think in the case of both of these, especially Peloton, it's just a matter of reorganizing the business, kind of figuring out priorities in this changing consumer landscape, and then kind of going from there. You know, Peloton had several kind of operational issues as well. During their biggest peak during the pandemic, they just could not keep up with demand. And a lot of customers were upset with them. So they're kind of trying to find their footing again. And I don't think either of these companies are going to go away necessarily. They're just reconsidering how they operate in this new landscape.
Well, I'd like to suggest a lower cost option for both companies. Maybe that would work.
Yeah, that would be great. And I know at least in Peloton's case, they have offered payment plans and cheaper offerings in the past, although cheap in scare quotes, it's still not exactly cheap by any means. One thing that we've been seeing a lot of is because people are ready to try new things or perhaps sick of their Pelotons, in some cases, they're selling them on like Facebook Marketplace or Craigslist. Obviously, these funds aren't going to Peloton in this case, so not really helping their business. But for consumers looking for, you know, a Peloton on the cheap, there's actually quite a market for that right now.
And they can still buy the classes, so Peloton will get some money.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Bethany, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Bethany Byron, she's an associate editor at Business Insider. And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. I am off tomorrow, but stay tuned to hear Michelle Alloy take over in her ever capable hands. You will be, so never fret. I'll see you on Monday.